John Fain.
On radio, online and on digital.
The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne.
And on ABC Victoria.
We have music performed for you in the studio. That's coming up shortly from Mama Kin. That's her trading name. Danielle Caruana is her real name. That's coming your way, as well as Nadia Tass, the theatre producer and filmmaker. Nick Deutsch is bringing in an oboe. Well, I don't know if he's bringing in an oboe, but maybe. We'll see. We'll find out. Sian Pryor, who occasionally has been known to trill the clarinet, is my co-host on The Conversation Now today. Morning to you, Sian.
Good morning, John.
Where you been?
Oh, I've been having a very lovely time this year travelling. I was travelling for about 10 weeks.
10 weeks?
Yeah.
I thought you were supposed to be a teacher at RMIT.
Yeah, well, I just kind of bailed out after first semester. And I've paid for it since I got back because I've been working like a maniac. But let's call it self-funded long service leave.
Good on you.
Because when you work freelance, you don't get things like long service leave.
No, I'm a great believer in running away.
Yeah. So I took off overseas for 6 weeks.
Where'd you go?
Oh, so I had a couple of weeks in Bali, yeah, staying with family, which was lovely, except I had a little motorbike accident, which was not so lovely.
Oh, what happened?
Oh, God, such a cliche of the Bali holiday, isn't it, the motorbike accident? I was on the back of my cousin's motorbike and someone reversed out really quickly, not reversed, someone accelerated out from behind us just as we were doing a U-turn and collected us on the way. So, yes, I was flying. I flew through the air and hit the road rather hard.
Which part of you hit the road first?
My left, kind of the whole of my left side, so hip and shoulders and knee.
You look all right. I didn't see any damage.
I was very lucky. Yeah. I've just added a few more aches and pains to the general, you know, ever-increasing list of aches and pains. But
and were we wearing a helmet, Charlie?
Of course I was wearing a helmet,
and was it just as well?
I'm a very sensible girl. Look, to be honest, because of the way I fell, I think I would even have been okay without a helmet because I kind of hit my rump mostly. And I thank whoever for years and years of Pilates, because I think that my whole body just went into this instant self-protective core muscle clench as I was flying through the air. Anyway, we won't talk about this for too long because it's all too yucky.
Were you badly hurt?
No, it's not badly hurt. I was pretty shocked and I was pretty bruised, but I was, I got off very lightly.
Was the motorbike okay?
Our motorbike was really good. The other guy's motorbike was not so good.
Oh, dear.
Anyway, so Bali was fun apart from that. And then I did this lovely thing. I went travelling in Wales with my mother and sister.
Wales.
Exploring some of the family heritage.
Beautiful.
Because, of course, with a name like Sian,
yep,
there is a great-great-grandfather who came from Wales. So
great.
Yes, so we went to the town where he emigrated from.
Called
Blenefin. I think that's how you pronounce it. A tiny little coal mining town, of course.
And the year we're talking about?
1852.
Early-ish.
And I tell you what, I was in Wales for the Brexit vote and I was travelling around those little depressed and depressing former coal mining towns while that decision was being ruminated in the minds of the Welsh.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of made sense for me in retrospect of the fact that about 53% of the Welsh voted to leave the European Union.
Which percent?
About 53%.
53.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because a recent poll was taken. So it was 53 for leaving, 47 against. And those figures, according to the latest polls, have now reversed. It's now by a remorse from, you know, about 6% of the population who would like to stay. But, I think that those, similar to what we've been seeing in America, and we won't go on about what's just happened in America because we're probably all heartily sick of it, but that real sense of people being left out, left behind, people's sense of identity and affiliation being stretched beyond what they're comfortable with. My pet theory about what was happening in Wales was, of course, the impact of the closure of so much of their industry. You know, so many employment areas have just completely collapsed over there. But also, you know, the Welsh, I think, have really struggled to maintain a sense of their own identity in the face of England, in the face of, you know, British identity, and then to be asked to stretch that sense of identity even further all the way through Europe. I just think they thought, no, we're Welsh. Just leave us alone. We're Welsh. We don't want to be British. We don't want to be European. We want to be Welsh. And it's kind of as simple as that.
Well, then now, you say now it's swinging the other way.
Well, I suspect now they're reading the newspapers, which are saying, oh, my goodness, this is going to be incredibly complicated. Did you know, Wales, that you received a huge amount of financial support and subsidy from the European Union? And do you know what's going to happen when that disappears? Do you know how much even harder it's going to be for you economically once that disappears?
Interesting to see not just Wales, but Ireland, Scotland, the fallout throughout the whole of the formerly united but now not united, disunited kingdom is fascinating to see. So what was it like travelling with your family?
Oh, it was so lovely.
Really? How many of you?
Just my mother and my sister and I.
So three of you.
Three girls. Yeah. And
when's the last time you travelled as a family?
I don't think we've ever travelled in that particular formation before. I mean, I've travelled.
You would have had holidays as a kid.
Yes, but you know, it was with the whole. It was with the boys as well, and often my sister wasn't there because she kind of left home early and was off doing her own thing. While, you know, I'm 6 years younger, so she was an adult when we were still kids. So, just a really, oh my goodness, such a precious time to have with your best girls, really. And we travelled really well together, you know. We had a lot of fun. We did a lot of laughing. We're interested in lots of the same things. So we went to, you know, places like Ludlow, which has been turned into Hay on Wye, which has been turned into a town full of secondhand bookshops. We thought we had died and gone to heaven.
What? Full of secondhand?
Full of secondhand. Fabulous story of some eccentric British, member of the aristocracy who inherited some crazy falling down castle, and he was a bookish, eccentric member of the aristocracy, as many of them probably are, and he started selling secondhand books, and he started this movement, which has now become like the main industry of this little old town.
How can you have a town whose industry is secondhand books?
Well, if you could see the numbers of tourists thronging the streets, filing in and out of these glorious little bookshops.
How many secondhand books can you buy when you're on holidays?
Well, too many in my instance, given that I was travelling for 6 weeks with one small suitcase. Oh, yeah, but I couldn't resist.
And
just
what particular books to particular things?
No, I just, you know, whatever I found that looked gorgeous and that I couldn't resist buying, I would grab. But you know, they had everything. They had antique books. They had, you know, contemporary secondhand books. They had new books. If you like books, go to this town because it's just paradise. So Wales, and then I went to Iceland, John.
Mm-hmm. Iceland.
Iceland.
Just because.
Just because, well, why wouldn't you?
Because it's there.
Because it's, well, I'll tell you, I was reinforced by when I got there for the decision because.
By ferry?
No, by plane.
Okay.
So, you know how if you do quite a lot of travelling, your threshold for being astonished gets higher and higher. You know, it gets harder and harder to be astonished when you're travelling. So the thing for me about Iceland was that every day I saw something entirely astonishing.
Like what?
Mostly nature, mostly the geography of that place.
Mm-hmm.
Waterfalls, fjords.
What time of year was it?
Thermally heated rivers.
So it was summer, was it?
It was midsummer, so it never really got dark. Whale watching at midnight, hiking up and down mountains, bathing in thermally heated rivers. Literally, you climb to the top of a mountain, put your bathers on and get in a river, and it feels like you're having a spa.
In the middle of the night?
No, this was actually in the middle of the day.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I was too tired by the night time. So, yeah, I'd say just get there if you can. Start saving now because it's a very expensive place,
okay.
Iceland.
Right.
But I'm going back as soon as I can.
Really?
Just beautiful.
Okay. Yep. Do you go back to places or do you like going somewhere new?
I love both, but I do find myself going back to places I love. I've been to Italy probably about 5 times.
Oh, well, aren't you lucky?
Yes, I am.
Hey on Why, the original book town, which was copied here by Clunes.
There you go.
There you go.
There you go.
Okay, very interesting. Well, good to have you back and back in harness at RMIT, teaching journalism and nonfiction writing.
And presenting on ABC Classic FM.
And presenting on ABC Classic FM. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Every Gosh. Thursday night.
Really?
Yeah.
I let you back in the door.
And I go, we got to kill Bin Laden, you know, let's do this.
It was just such an elaborate lie.
If you point a gun at an audience, it makes them nervous.
Hi, my name is Sammy Shah, and I am a comedian and writer who's doing a podcast called Laughing Dead, which is about comedians telling stories about their worst gigs.
Just walked up the middle of the aisle, took the microphone out of my hand and went, that's enough, darling.
No. Subscribe to it. You need more than one podcast in your life, and let Laughing Dead be the next one.
From time to time, for some reason, I don't quite know why, performers accept our invitation to come into the studio at what for them is usually the wrong end of the day. And then with almost no technical setup, they agree to just subject themselves to the extremely harrowing ordeal of performing for us in the studio.
Way to make me feel comfortable.
Danielle Caruana performs as Mama Kin. She's accepted our invitation.
I don't know now. I mean, that just sounded, I mean, you could have said many encouraging things then.
Those are all encouraging.
They were terrifying.
No, it's about getting the audience to understand just how hard it is for people to just come in here and blurt it out the way so many of you do. It's absolutely wonderful.
So I've got blurt and I've got harrowing to play over through my mind while I sing this deep...
Wrong end of the day, don't forget that.
Oh, wrong end of the day, yeah. No, I feel fine.
And no
I'm
technical
ready.
Setup, don't
No technical
that.
Setup, I'm ready. I trust this wonderful production staff who are looking at me through the window.
Yeah,
and
with wonderment.
Yeah.
What are we going to get, Danielle?
I'm going to play 2 songs today, but the first song I'm going to play is Redwood River, which is a song off my last album, The Magician's Daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And... yeah, it's one of those songs that I wrote and I couldn't even perform for quite a while because it was so, it hurt to sing. I think I was, in this song, I faced my deepest fear as a parent because it was sort of getting in the way of my parenting, this kind of idea of their mortality. And, it really started to interrupt my joy of being around them because I was so nervous all the time. So I thought, I actually have to find a way to face this beast and let it scream in my face. And this song was that exercise. Now I don't even know if I'm going to be able to sing it because I've made myself too emotional. But, so this song was that exercise, and having to sing it over and over again was my medicine.
Sitting on the banks of your calm disguise, I see deep these murderous waters, twisted covenant and dark lies, the redwood stole. And left me here to die. I close my eyes, I hear her cry, softly whisper, Mama, Mama, in the redwood shade and time, I've made up my mind. My joining now is nigh. Oh, my daughter, my angel daughter, in the Redwood River, broken bones and mud. Oh, my daughter, my raven daughter, the Redwood River, water is thicker than. I slip into her frozen hands. She drips and draws me to her, sliding down a muddy bank. Surrender to the tide. The redwood drinks my life. Oh, my daughter, my angel daughter, in the redwood river, broken bones and mud. water. The redwood river water's thicker than blood. I can't abide this gray earth without the glow of her smile. And I cannot stay here while her gentle face is in those waters. Oh, my daughter, my angel daughter, in the redwood river, broken bones and mud. Oh, my daughter, my raven daughter, the redwood river water's thicker than blood. The redwood river water's thicker than blood. The redwood river water's thicker than
love. That was fantastic.
Thank you.
Beautiful song, Danielle. And so that's inspired by deeply personal things, which mm-hmm. and it comes through. So we'll chat some more and stay with us for the conversation hour today. Mama Kin is the performing name of Danielle Caruana, who's here for Melbourne Music Week.
You know, it's so interesting, Danielle, because I teach a course on writing as therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, exactly what you described before you sang that beautiful song is exactly what I actually encourage people to do, is face the worst possible thing, make yourself write it out and get it away from you, turn it into something else and get it away from you.
It becomes less abstract and... yeah, it sort of takes it out of the ether and puts it into the real present. And all of my music is that. All of my music is medicine. In fact, when I was writing, I never had the intention of sharing it. That was a secondary result, actually. I was really writing because I had this body of energy that I needed to deal with. And yeah, so that's exactly.
Medicine or therapy, I suppose. Yeah. Nadia Tass
that's
is our
exactly.
first guest. Morning
Sorry.
To you, Nadia.
I have to comment on this. That was incredible.
Thank you.
And that was exactly why I made Malcolm.
Oh, right.
My film.
Because?
Which is about my brother.
Right.
Malcolm is inspired by my brother.
Oh.
And it's because we lost him. And I had to do something to celebrate that life.
Yeah.
And for a long time, I couldn't talk about it.
Yeah.
And until the film was there, it was all bottled up inside?
Totally.
And once the film is there, it's in the film?
Well, it's in the film. I still didn't talk about it, but it was there. The expression of that pain and the celebration of that life is on the screen. And in fact, it was 30 years, and there was a screening two nights ago at the Astor.
What was your brother's name?
John. And John Tassopoulos.
Are we allowed to know what happened? Do we need to know? Do you want to tell us?
It was an accident on the road, coming back from Melbourne Uni, and he died.
Mm.
And the shock would never leave you?
Never.
Ever.
This is years. Mm. This is the early 80s.
Mm.
And I'm still in a bit of a state referencing it, but I love watching the film and watching it with people. So thank you,
You're
Danielle.
Welcome.
Fantastic. yes, therapy.
And, catharsis. And it's catharsis, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, and so much of what we do is,
isn't
it? I mean, we're all dealing. Everyone has a story. Every single person has a story. Everyone's got some driving force or motivation, whether it's grief or loss or pain or love or whatever.
And that's kind of what the alchemy of creativity is, isn't it? It's like taking one thing and turning it into another thing, which enables it to become much larger and resonant for everybody, not just you and your personal grief
story. This is the interesting thing, because as I said before, I used to write for my own catharsis, and I thought my stories were almost too personal to be shared, that no one could possibly understand the deep sort of intrinsic situation that I was in and that created that story. But I found that actually the more intimate the story, when I would come off stage, they were the songs that people would go, I felt like you wrote that for me.
Yes. You could have written. Or you told my story.
You told my story up there. I was like, okay, well, that was the one that I thought no one could possibly relate to. That was the one I feel most isolated in. And that's the true catharsis, isn't it, is the realisation of our connecting stories, how but similar they are.
The more individual that piece of creativity is, the more it's going to relate on a personal level.
Isn't that amazing, though?
Which is extraordinary.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
And so the expression through theatre, through music, through film, I think is not only a healing process, but also a means of communication and sharing.
Because it's about what's universal, isn't it? I mean, I know that sounds a bit abstract, but, you know, you're about to direct a production of a Chekhov play, Uncle Vanya, you know, written,
1897.
a century and a half ago, and yet those stories, those characters, those situations that Chekhov described are so kind of deeply humanly universal that will never become out of date.
Well, that was the reason I really wanted to do Vanya now, because whereas he's talking about crippling boredom in 1897 or during that time in Russia, it is so relevant to today. And he is also talking about unrequited love. And then whilst I revisited this material, I found just how much Chekhov was extraordinarily connected to what our planet needs. And so through this story, he's talking about ecological needs of the Earth. One of the characters in there is the doctor, who basically...
What's the story of Uncle Vanya?
A professor, a university professor, goes back to the plantation that he lives in, or he lived in with his first wife. Now he's coming back with his second wife. And whilst he's there, his presence cripples everybody and nobody can work.
Because?
Because there are all sorts of human entanglements and needs. The love interest is really profound in the piece. One person loves another person who loves somebody else, and they seem to be immobilized by this need for love, which is unrequited love. And then, but their presence, this is the professor and his wife's presence, are just like a cloud over everybody.
Oh, love can do that.
Wow.
It can do that. Oh, it's immobilising.
It's tricky.
Hey, Nadia, I've been watching... Sorry to interrupt. I've been watching Bloodline.
Yes.
The American drama series starring our Ben Mendelsohn,
yes,
who you've worked with on two or three films now.
Ben, five films.
There you go.
And Ben and I are really close.
So as I've been watching Bloodline and thinking about Chekhov and Uncle Vanya, I've been thinking, this script probably owes a huge debt to Chekhov. This is a really similar plot line. There's a guy who comes back to the family, and there's a whole lot of family secrets, and you know, he has a kind of unrequited love for his father.
You're saying they've ripped off Chekhov on Bloodline?
Well, no, I'm just... what am I saying? I'm saying that these stories, these universal stories, just keep going and going through our culture. So, you know, I have no idea whether the people who wrote Bloodline, you know, are Chekhov fans at all, but the plot similarities are quite striking. And again, it says this is why a play like, you know, Uncle Vanya, written 130 years ago, still resonates, because we're still getting versions of this same constellation of human relationships in crisis.
It is. It's those human relationships and how they drive the plot forward that keep the audience really interested. I'm just fascinated by his acute understanding of the human condition during that time and how his understanding is profound and relevant today.
Lust and boredom never goes stale.
It doesn't.
Perfectly put.
Speaking of universal, now this production, the Red Stitch Actors Theatre are putting it on, Uncle Vanya by Anton Chekhov, directed by Nadia Tass, is it Is it historical? Are you framing it in the past or in the present? How are you setting it? What's the production?
I'm setting it at a time that's not purely 1890s. It's some time in the past, but I'm not defining that because I don't want it to really be about that. I am focusing very strongly on Chekhov's extraordinary opinion and understanding of the planet's ecological needs, because that was the thing that I found on rereading the piece. And also I'm using Annie Baker's adaptation of this. Annie Baker is a new voice, or is a voice in America, who is a wonderful writer, playwright, and now she's writing for television as well. And she has really pinned the things, the aspects of this work that appeals, not just appeals to me, but really I think it's about. Certainly the relevance of today is what Annie has pinned.
How different is Annie's version to Chekhov's version?
Chekhov's version? Well, it's Chekhov. She has. She's very, very religious. She's staying very true to what he wrote.
Doesn't change the plot, or
no. It's absolutely Chekhov. Mm. But over the years,
lost the
plot. Boom, boom.
Over the years, there are many adaptations that really have moved away from his intention, and now it's really going back to that. But as I say, you know, the more specific we are, the more universal we become.
Nadia Tass, theatre, film and television director, is now the director of Uncle Vanya by Anton Chekhov, a new version by Annie Baker. It's at Red Stitch. Uncle Vanya by Anton Chekhov, directed by our guest Nadia Tass. Sian Pryor is my co-host on The Conversation Hour today. Danielle Caruana performing as Mama Kin has another song for us.
I do.
Is this one about lust and loneliness as well?
Actually, yeah, it's exactly about lust and loneliness. It's a song I haven't released yet. It's a newie. It's a newbie.
What's this one about?
This one is about lust and loneliness. It's about...
What's it called?
It's called Am I Everything You Ever Wanted? I'm just going to sing the song. Last night I couldn't sleep. I was wrecked by a vision from a dream. Her arm was draped around your neck. You were happy, you were safe in her embrace. Oh, you were laughing, you were home in her embrace. Am I everything you need? Am I enough? Just say the word, I'll leave. Is she everything you ever wanted? In her arms, can you feel what's wrong with me? Oh, in her arms, can you feel what's wrong with me? In the morning we were clinging to our opposite sides of the bed. There was a valley scorched between us. I called to you, you couldn't make out what I said. Oh, when I spoke, you couldn't make out what I said. Am I everything you need? Am I enough? Just say the word, I'll leave. Is she everything you ever wanted? In her arms, can you feel what's wrong with me? Oh, in her arms, can you feel what's wrong with me? I won't listen to the whispers. I want to see the words fall.
falling from your mouth. I will listen to the ache in my guts when you say you'll be late, you're caught up, you'll be home soon enough. Last night I couldn't sleep. I was wrecked by a vision from a dream. Her arm was draped around your neck. You were happy, you were safe. Her embrace. Oh, you were laughing, you were home. Her embrace.
Oh, wow. I hope that is being released soon. That's fantastic.
Thank
song.
You.
It is absolutely fantastic song. Danielle Caruana performs as Mama Kin and
yes.
performs impromptu here in the studio.
No She's, pressure.
She, none at all. if that's how you perform without pressure, I'd love to see how you respond to a bit. It was just fantastic. What a
Thank
great
you.
Song, Danielle. That's absolutely fabulous. Stay Thank with you. Us. Danielle Caruana, Nadia Tass and I are joined by Hurry, 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 ladies and gentlemen. Yes, that's right. Steak knives come with it. Nick Deutsch, oboist and artistic director of the Australian National Academy of Music. There's a program of music coming your way, and Nick's here to tell us about it. Morning to you, Nick.
Good morning.
No, no steak knives. Just oboes.
Not yes. Let's see where we get.
Always give the customer more than they ask for, Nick.
Well, I mean, cooking is one of my passions in life, so steak knives is quite relevant, but that's not necessarily what I came to talk about this morning, but yeah, as I said,
I think oboists should be very careful around steak knives, because if you chop your fingers,
well,
you're in trouble.
Believe it or not, as an oboist, part of our craft is actually making our own rings.
Yes, I know. My mum was an oboist.
Oh,
I
fantastic.
Grew up with the making of oboes.
I'm sorry. So we do carry knives with us everywhere we go.
Now, the oboe is the great big long tube.
That's a bassoon.
That's a bassoon.
So we sit just in front of them in the orchestra. It is a double reed instrument,
right?
But looks similar to a clarinet, so it's sort of black wood with silver keys, but it's much smaller.
A European didgeridoo.
You could call it that, I suppose, yeah. Okay.
Ever tried to play didgeridoo?
I have. I'm not too good at it, actually, to be honest.
All right. Yeah.
Better to be a trumpeter, really, if you want to play didge.
Yeah. Well, circular breathing is what's important, and, I've got very relaxed embouchure, working different muscles.
Whereas oboists need a really good chops, really tight embouchure.
Absolutely.
Circular breathing is what you need to be a politician, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
And then you can talk without being interrupted because you just never pause for breath.
I think many have mastered it.
They have, indeed. They've worked it out. Tell us about the National Academy of Music, based now at the Old South Melbourne Town Hall.
Yes. We're based in Melbourne, although we do represent, musicians come from all over the country. So it is a national institute of music, and we also have students from New Zealand. And we're an elite school, very small, just 66 students. And it's a practical-based, so it's a real performance-based institution. So most students come to us once they've completed some sort of undergraduate degrees at other institutions around Australia.
I love the way you said the word elite without flinching.
Well, it
because
is.
Because it's become a rude word, hasn't it?
Well, it shouldn't be. I mean, it's. The whole idea of the school is to really cater for the very, very best. And then when we do have such a small cohort, we can really tailor to the needs of each individual. Australia has actually made an international mark in the world on a musical level. It's really quite astounding how many of the leading positions around the world are filled by Australians.
And you, that's
really, I just find this very interesting, because on the acting front, we have NIDA, mm-hmm. and a number of other institutions, of course, and our actors have gone out there and been accepted and are shining on a world scale. And our brief conversation before coming in here...
Oh, you never do that.
...was
there,
about...
There is no conversation before
Nothing happens
here.
So this is the conversation. So I was asking about... You know, if a young person wants to go to New York and study music, then is Annam absolutely a great alternative.
Absolutely. I mean, I came to Melbourne to study. I'm originally from Sydney, and I studied at the Victorian College of the Arts. But at the completion of my studies, it was obvious that I needed to go overseas. And since
why was that obvious?
Well, I suppose in a word, isolation. I mean, we are very isolated. We're far away. I mean, in Germany, a young music student can hop on a train and in an hour's time, he has access to many, many various sort of ensembles, traditions. Here in Australia, it's logistically a lot more complicated.
Oh, just get on a plane. What's your problem?
But it's also a population issue, isn't it? We just don't actually have the numbers of people to generate the numbers of musical ensembles to provide A, enough work, B, enough kind of sense of where the bar is and raising the bar constantly so that you become a better and better musician. I mean, I find it simultaneously kind of, it fills me with pride that so many Australian musicians are, as you say, filling the chairs in some of the best ensembles in the world, but makes me so sad that they all have to leave.
Well, they don't necessarily all have to leave. I mean, I think, like in any profession, sometimes people do like to get away to see how things are done in other parts of the world, especially when one is talking about music and that's where it all started. That's where historically the first impetus all came from. So a lot of people want to experience that. But what the idea behind ANAM is actually bringing the rest of the world to Australia. Mm. And it's not only a training institution, the fact that the people that come in teach our students, but they actually perform alongside them. So if you look at next year's what we've released today is next year's season. We have many of the world's leading performers coming who will share the stage as colleagues with our finest young musicians.
We speak about the tyranny of distance here, but sometimes that tyranny of distance can really work in our favour. Our concentration, our pursuit of excellence through what our endeavour is, I think can be so much more focused, which is what I see certainly with the arts in terms of theatre and acting and directing. So surely that's the same with the musicians, is it not?
Absolutely, absolutely.
And so because we're able, to, as John says, to get on a plane and within 24 hours we're in Europe or within 10 hours we're in America, I don't see that that's a problem, and I don't see that it's a problem to leave and to come back and to keep leaving and coming back.
Well, I mean, the world has changed in many ways. In the time when I grew up as a student in Australia, there was actually, apart from going to Europe, you had no access to what was going on there. Today, of course, with digital media, YouTube gives us access to anything, yeah.
Different line of inquiry, Nick. How does it advance the training of students at the National Academy of Music to perform Frank Zappa's Yellow Shark? How does Studebaker Hawk possibly help their career?
Well, look, that's just another piece in the very big puzzle, the larger picture. And I think what's really important is what we try and do is we try and give our young musicians access to the broadest possible repertoire, which means that when they do get out there into the profession, they're ready for anything the profession throws at them.
And including the mothers of invention.
Well, absolutely. Well, Zappa
is
actually
absolute
quite
innovator.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
That's true. It really is an original voice. I mean,
you make me want to go home, drag out the vinyl, crank up the turntable, and listen to it for the first time in probably 30 years.
Or even better, come and hear it live. It's just down the road. And Ensemble Modern, who actually premiered it with Zappa, will be coming along to work with our young musicians so that they get
They must all be
access.
120.
Oh, not at all. Not
so,
at all.
John, this week and next week, there's a series of concerts going on which are tributes to David Bowie, which ensembles like the Adelaide Symphony Orchestra and the West Australian Symphony Orchestra are playing for. So, you know, I mean, this is perfectly sensible
the purists
of
will
Nick
be spinning in their
to
graves.
Give these musicians experience of working with people like Danielle. Why don't you do a collaboration with Danielle?
Yeah, jeez.
Yeah, I was just hearing. I've
just been sitting here waiting for you to invite me.
We're going to swap business cards, yeah.
But there will be people, the purists, who will be saying, oh my goodness, this is a betrayal of everything that a classical musical education should be about.
I would totally disagree. I think this is, I mean, it's not, the work that we're doing is a classical work, you could call it. It's contemporary, sort of in style, but it's definitely in the genre that we train our musicians to play. What most contemporary
you're
ensembles...
do some Madonna next or Beyonce?
No, that's different.
Snob,
I mean,
John. Yeah, really, John. Just take it easy, you boss.
Well, if we can do Chekhov now, why not?
Well, we're doing Lior on Sunday.
Yay. Oh,
and wow, Lior has done one of the most beautiful collaborations with one of our best Australian composers.
Nigel Westlake, absolutely.
With Compassion.
It really does sound fantastic.
It's one of the most moving pieces of music I've heard in decades.
Yeah, yeah. I can absolutely recommend everybody who has some free time on Sunday afternoon to come along to Emerald Hill in front of the South Melbourne Town Hall, and they'll get to hear our wonderful Anna musicians and Lior. For those who are busy on Sunday, they still have an opportunity to come tonight to the Melbourne Recital Centre, where we'll be performing with a very young but fantastic Venezuelan conductor, Ilyich Rivas, Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony and Stravinsky's masterpiece, The Firebird, as well as Ginastera's Piano Concerto, which is very rarely done, but it's a fantastic piece of music.
There's so much on. One of the things, we've got Melbourne Music Week, we've got Australian Music Month, you've got your program. There's, as Sian said a moment ago, there's so many performances on. It is quite extraordinary. It's part of Melbourne's reputation as a great sporting and events capital, but in fact the grassroots music movement is reviving. I remember how many predictions. Pokies weren't going to kill, the tobacco laws were going to kill the music industry, the liquor licensing restrictions weren't going to kill, so many things, this, everything. Nothing kills the music business. Nothing kills the desire for people to perform and the desire for people to attend and consume. It's extraordinary.
Yep.
And now it's going to be so much, there's so much more reason to get out there and compose and create plays and films because of the, I guess, seeming or actual chaos in the world, politically, yeah. Socially.
What are you talking about? What
oh,
chaos?
I don't know. with the change, with the big changes politically, I think hopefully people are going to be inspired to create so much more theatre.
Donald Trump's great for comedy.
Oh, he's fabulous.
No, he's made comedy redundant. He's certainly made satire redundant.
He's brought comedy to the White House.
He's beyond comedy. We weren't going to talk about him, John.
But the way all this new wave is going to affect, you know, Brexit, Donald Trump, or the way this is going to affect us, the normal human beings, I think, and what our needs are going to be, we'll definitely need expression through the arts.
The more chaotic the world, the more people look for answers, surely.
Yeah.
And then you turn to creative people, whether it's art, music, theatre, whatever it might be, as a way of trying to understand what's going on and also sometimes to seek some respite, some escape.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's so interesting, John, because it's consolation. I felt very shocked yesterday about He Who Shall Not Be Named being elected in that country that shall not be named. And the one kind
did you,
of...
Like, I know someone who's pretending they're in a dream and they're going to wake up at some point. They're just wondering how long they can persist with that.
No, but the one consolation for me was last night I presented a five-hour-long program on ABC Classic FM, and all day long I kept thinking, if I can just make it to 7 o'clock, then I can have a warm bath of Mozart and that will make everything feel okay. And it certainly helped.
But it's 4 years. It's 4 years that we're looking at. Within that four-year period, the world will survive. Will be
yeah, the
presented.
The sun still comes up.
Absolutely. We will be presented with different challenges and we deal with every hurdle that comes around. And the truth is, a group of people went out there and they voted. Another group of people decided not to vote. And so we have Donald Trump as the leader because he was able to inspire a whole lot of people to get over to the polling booths.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a bit simple.
I wonder what Donald Trump thinks of the arts. Haven't really heard much about that. Interesting to know.
He might see himself in a number of productions, though.
Well, you know, there's been a lot of talk about the influence of reality television on this election campaign, and particularly the influence of, you know, Trump's huge celebrity status within reality television. Nadia, you've worked a lot in the States and you've worked a lot in the television, well, the screen industry. What are your thoughts about the rise and rise of reality television and how it might impact, well, how it might intersect with politics?
Well, we've just witnessed it. So it's inevitable that, you know, when people are tired, they come home from work, they turn on the television, they don't want to watch the news. And what they tune into is something that's superficial and very light, which is reality television. And, of course, that's where Donald Trump became such a strong figurehead. And as a result of that, people heard his name. They've had all these decades to actually find out who he is. And whether it's a positive or a negative experience with the program or with this human being or the symbol of this human being, it's almost irrelevant. The fact that he was there and people were listening to him, I think, has contributed to his success.
I think the interesting thing is, in comparison to the last time the American public, or the country that shall not be named, public voted for a television figure, it was Ronald Reagan, and they knew he was acting, right? So the idea that they feel in some way that through the channel of reality TV, they've actually connected to a genuine aspect of someone's personality. That's the thing that I find fascinating, is that it's even called reality TV, and that it's even perceived as being a true indication of what someone's like, and that that can even be attractive. I mean, I think that says so much about how we engage with media now, and the faith we put into it, and the intimacy that we have with it, or that the public can have with it. And I think just those two examples of, you know, even Schwarzenegger, and, you know, he had to build a persona beyond his acting self to then be voted in. As did Ronald Reagan, whereas Trump was like, well, I've already shown myself and I'm going to continue with that persona that I've shown and I've built through that channel. I just think that's fascinating. Mm.
I think the difficulty that I'm having is the very strong swing to the right. Sure, you know, Donald Trump is the figurehead, but it's really the strong swing to the right that I think, for me, is a problem, creating a much stronger chasm between the haves and the have-nots.
Mm. Oh, no, they say they'll obliterate it. They'll, in fact, lift people up is their claim, and this will put it to the test.
But the Republican Party in this election is not the same as the Republican Party 8 years ago. It's definitely shifted to the right.
But this will put it to the test. We're seeing an experiment here in whether or not this can actually work, and we'll be sitting back and watching with great interest, surely.
Oh.
But the question is, did they really, were they voting for Trump or were they voting against the establishment? I think it's a lot of people, it was a signal also to say that people aren't happy with what's going on, and they don't necessarily.
There's a lot not to be happy about.
Sure, as an alternative, but they wanted to show objection to what they had as an alternative.
I think Trump had the perfect phrase, make America great again. Mm. And that's what seems to be in the fore of the voters' minds. They want to be part of something that's great, they believe.
Sure, but you can go to Mongolia and they want to be great again. They used to have a great Mongolian empire and they conquered half the known world and they want to be great again in Mongolia too.
And Australia's desperate to be world-class.
It's what Vladimir Putin tells the Russians. We will make Russia great again. We've been mucked around by the West since the collapse of the empire and we will be great again. It's a universal theme. Everywhere you go, people
want to
be great.
I think it's more of a reflection of the great amount of disenchantment there is out there, and not that Shian and I would dare to have a conversation off mic, but just say we had. We may have touched on this on our way into the studio around how much is Brexit and Trump a reflection of the actual great amount of disenchantment there is out there right now with the status quo.
Nothing happens off mic. I mean, really, I don't know what you're suggesting.
Sorry, so rude.
Nick Deutsch is an oboist. He's professor of oboe in Leipzig, but he's also artistic director when he's here of the National Academy of Music, the ANAM at South Melbourne. They've launched their program today. And if you want to see a live performance of Frank Zappa's Yellow Shark, performed with the Ensemble Moderne? Well, that's one of the things you can find out about by going to the Australian National Academy of Music website and learning about all the details, and that certainly sounds like a fantastic thing. And, of course, all my questions, Nick, are designed to provoke conversation. I'm a huge Frank Zappa fan, and I think it's great that the students learn to do that sort of stuff as part of their training rather than just in their own spare time. Nadia Tass is directing Chekhov's Uncle Vanya at Red Stitch Actors Theatre starting next week. Mama Kin is the performing name of Danielle Caruana, our other guest, who's sung a couple of fabulous songs for us today. And have a look at the Melbourne Music Week program, because there's stuff going on all around the joint that you can join in on. Sian Pryor, my co-host. Thank you all for coming. This has been The Conversation Hour on your ABC.
The Conversation Hour podcasts are available at abc.net.au/Melbourne. Subscribe now and you'll receive automatic updates with special guests, interesting interviews. It's a bit of fun. You'll be mad not to subscribe. abc.net.au/Melbourne.